All right.
Let's go. Batter up. It's the baseball edition of the Priestcast. And we're here with our favorite baseball man. You'll remember him from our first episode. It's Sam.
Thank you. Thank you.
What's up, man? How you doing?
Oh, I am. Oh, it's Sunday. It's Sunday and it's spring training. And we're going to talk about some heavy metal today. So it can't get much better.
Can't get much better than that. So you have switched allegiance from one team to another. Yeah. Sam was a huge A's fan. Yeah. Still are?
Well, you know, in hindsight, you know, I liken it to having lost your team, having your team moved. It's just that they haven't moved yet. You know what I mean? So trying to enjoy other teams have less of a tendency to frustrate through the process of baseball. I've got some family and friends from Pittsburgh area. I've always followed the Pirates as well. I've always been a kind of guy who follows a few teams, but yeah, so watches the Pirates this year. I'll probably catch some A's. Yeah, that's me. But I'm from Massachusetts by birth, so I've caught many games at Fenway in my life as well. Most of the games I've been to in my life, well, probably 50-50, Fenway and the old Coliseum in Oakland.
Yeah, the Oakland Coliseum, actually, the Priest, on their first U.S. tour, played two baseball stadiums. Now, the first stadium was Busch Stadium in St. Louis, and it was, I think they were opening for REO Speedwagon and Foreigner. But at this show at Busch Stadium, it was headlined by Ted Nugent. So that was in 1977. Now, after they crisscrossed the state towards the end of the tour, they got a call from management in London asking if they wanted to open for the mighty Led Zeppelin. So Robert Plant heard that Priest were touring the States, and he requested that they open two shows at the Day on the Green Festival in Oakland, at the Oakland Coliseum in 1977. Yeah. So Robert Plant and Priest go way back, of course, to the Birmingham days. They would see each other play. They hung out, see each other play clubs. Of course, Plant's Band of Joy practice along with Priest at Holy Joe's. So the Day on the Green Festival was held at the Oakland Alameda Coliseum, and that was the very last show Led Zepp ever played in the United States with the original lineup.
Wow.
So the Oakland Coliseum, when was that built? Because this was 1977.
So that was 77. The
Coliseum was built in the 60s.
Yeah, it was built in 1966. It was opened in 1966, so it had been built a little bit before that. And then trying to think when they added Mount Davis. I want to say that was the 90s.
Yeah, something like that.
Was when they added the, but yeah, I mean, it was the Day on the Green was a huge series of music festivals. They were huge.
Yeah, yeah, at the Oakland Coliseum. So yeah, that's pretty cool. You saw games where Priest opened for the mighty Led Zepp. That's awesome.
I know, it's wild. It's wild.
And historic, because that was the last show that they played in the States with the original lineup. Unfortunately, Robert Plant's son Carrick got an infection and passed away. So right after that, kind of a bummer. I just brought the whole show down. I'm sorry.
Well, I can bring it back up. I see if without Googling, see if you can tell me the next Day on the Green. So 1978, the very next one. Can you take a stab at who was the headliner for that?
Have no idea.
The
Who?
Oh, you're close. The Who, Grateful Dead. No, the very next one. So this would have been May 28th, 1978, was headlined by the Beach Boys.
Whoa. All right. Sam sending out some good vibrations.
Although Grease related, Dolly Parton opened up that one.
Oh, all right. Good old Dolly.
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. So stadiums, you've changed affiliation to the Pittsburgh Pirates, which is my favorite stadium.
PNC Park. Yeah, PNC Park is gorgeous. Yeah, it's a great place to go to a game for sure.
I'd love to go there. Of course, I'd love to go to Fenway too.
They're both great in their own ways. I'd say PNC is really an experience. It's gorgeous and it's an experience, really well put together experience for fans.
Yeah. So, Jeff, you're a Sox fan.
I am. I've been to Fenway a couple times. First time I went, I was with my brother, and we were touring around the stadium, and we were making our way out to the Green Monster. We didn't have tickets up there. I don't even think the seats were built on top of the monster yet. And we're heading out there, and Carl Crawford nails a home run over the wall, literally as we're standing at the wall. I was like, okay, cool. That hit everything I wanted, and that was it. So.
So you grabbed a beer, turned around, and left.
Pretty much.
I've seen it all.
Yep.
And then they traded Carl Crawford to the Dodgers.
Yeah.
Oh, so Carl Crawford was on the Red Sox at the time. Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So, Sam, you dabble a lot in baseball cards.
I do. Yeah, yeah. Painfully so. A lot, money-wise. yes, I do. I tend to collect specifically signed cards. It's my wheelhouse.
So do you collect or do you resell or?
I only resell if it's as a last, if you pull something huge that I have no interest in, then sure. But I prefer to trade. I think trading is more fun.
So what are you thinking this year as far as, maybe playoffs, World Series, what teams you looking at?
Oh boy. Yeah, that's a good question. It's hard to look away from the Dodgers. Even with Ohtani at 50%, assuming he's not gonna be pitching this year. It's still an incredible team they've got. Their Achilles heel is also what gets them to the playoffs to begin with, which is Clayton Kershaw.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Great pitcher, just can't seem to get it done in the postseason. But I think they've still got a really solid, solid line. I mean, that would be my pick. My guess.
Yeah, I think the experts are actually picking the Braves as being the best team in the National League this year, which I'm a huge Dodger fan, born and raised in LA. So of course I'm a huge Dodger fan, but man, when it gets to the playoffs, they just can't get their shit together. It's annoying.
It is. it's hard to watch, teams that have proven themselves just fail. And of course, part of that's how the games are managed. Part of that's luck. Part of that's psychology. But the Braves have a great shot.
Yeah, they have a stellar team. I don't know about your socks though, Jeff. It's not looking good.
No, they're gonna be bad. It's my interest in baseball wanes when the Sox are doing so terribly, and it's I still haven't gotten over Mookie Betts being traded. That just hurts so bad. We were talking about earlier the Josh Beckett, Carl Crawford trade where the Red Sox really ripped off the Dodgers. Well, the Dodgers just screwed over the Sox on the Mookie Betts trade. That was awful. So
yeah, great for my Dodgers though. And yep. My wife is a diehard baseball and Sox fan. We have Sox, Red Sox paraphernalia all around the house. So yeah, she was a little perturbed as well. But we'll get over it. I mean, we were married when the Sox and Dodgers were in the World Series, and we managed to get through that. So So, Jeff, you're going to a show right after this.
Yeah, I'm. As soon as we're done recording, I am on my way to see Vader, Origin, and Inhuman Condition. Vader is a old school death metal band. They formed in like 1983, and started off as just kind of a traditional heavy metal band. And by the time they released their first album in early 90s, they were a full on death metal band. And so they're celebrating like a 40-year anniversary or something. And then Inhuman Condition and Origin, I'm not all that familiar with, but it's going to be fun. Going to hook up with some friends and listen to some heavy ass metal.
Nice. Gonna get in the pit and, you know, act.
No, dude, I haven't gotten in the pit in like 15 years. I would be on my, I'd be in bed for a week.
So, Sam, how's your band doing, man? You play bass.
Oh, yeah, we're it's a little, as long as it's cold, we're a little, you know, our season is slow, but, you know, a couple gigs a month until the summer, and then things get busy. Yeah, but we had one on Friday night, and yeah, so it's been a good time. It always is.
Good deal, good deal. And speaking of good times, I'm not very smart, as all of you know, and all of you listening know. So actually, when the folks are listening to this right now, the new album, Invincible Shield, will have dropped. But see, I'm too stupid to plan ahead, because we are going to have a very special guest to review the album on our next episode. But what I should have done was record that episode to correspond with the dropping of Invincible Shield, but I'm not very smart. But speaking of Invincible Shield, we are going to have someone very cool to go over the new album. It'll be a week late, but and a dollar short, but oh well. But I think everybody will really enjoy our guest. But that being said, The Serpent and the King was the fourth single dropped from this album. Have you guys heard that one?
Absolutely.
What do you think?
It's my favorite of the new ones. It's a burner. It has a great solo. It by far my favorite.
Sam?
It's great. You know, I in terms of whether or not it's my favorite, I don't even know if I could. I really quite liked. I liked Serpent and the King quite a bit. I thought it was, like you said, it's, you know, it's a banger. It's like straight up and down energy, full of a lot of what I frankly really liked about Firepower album. You know, I still, it's hard for me to say for sure that I like it more so far than Crown of Horns, but I might. It's going to take a little time for me to figure it out.
So you dig Crown of Horns? Yeah, we haven't talked about Crown of Horns.
Yeah, I think we talked the last time I was on. We were talking about Trial by Fire, if I remember.
Right. Yeah, that was when Trial by Fire came out. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in between, we have the Crown of Horns.
Yeah.
And so you like that equally, probably, to Serpent.
So far, yeah. So far, I do.
Cool. Yeah, I think Serpent and the King, out of the four singles, is my favorite as well. I dig the opening riff and the riff overall. And I like the changes in the song. It's really great tempo. The rhythm section is real tight and driving. I mean, it's like this song, it just drives. It drives hard. And you were right last time you were on, Sam, talking about the mix and how Ian is mixed.
Mm-hmm.
In the new record, and that really comes through in this song. The rhythm section is awesome. I really miss KK though.
Sure.
You know, this song would be perfect for like a classic Priest dueling solo, you know? And
there's
I was just going to say, I kind of miss that. You know, we haven't had that difference in styles since Nostradamus. You know, KK and Glenn have totally separate styles, but when they mesh, when they put it together, especially in a dueling solo sense, you could really see the differences, and they play off each other so well. And Richie is awesome, and I dig the solo, but all you can hear is his style, which is awesome, but it's just one style. And I just wish that there's a little difference in style. So when I heard the solo, although it kicks ass, it just screams dueling solo to me. You know, two different styles playing off each other. That's all. But no, it's a great song. I don't know why I went off on that tangent, but
no, I mean, it's a fair point. There is the observation when listening to Invincible Shield, to a certain extent, when listening to Firepower as well, you know, that there is a predominant guitar player on the album, and that being Richie Faulkner. And he, you know, in performing when Glenn was more capable, when Glenn was less ill, you know, there was a little bit more of that trade-off. But I think this, as I mentioned the last time I was on, this album, very much like Firepower, has Richie's DNA on it, which is awesome, but it's certainly different, you know, than having, you know, sort of two predominant guitars. It is definitely different. It's not to say that there aren't a bunch of guitar parts, but, you know, it's a very Faulkner DNA oriented album. To me, you know, I enjoy that a lot, I think, but I get, you know, missing the contrast.
Yeah, well, and I'm a sucker for, you know, the 70s stuff, which the styles, especially in the early 70s, are so different. You know, the later you get to Painkiller and stuff like that, and although you could still tell the difference, stylistically they kind of got closer together, whereas, like, you know, the real early stuff, the stylistic, both of them were so different. But, you know, they kind of, especially the reunion records with KK and Glenn, they kind of got close to not the same stylistically, but a little closer. There's a little less difference, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. I don't know what I'm trying to say. I just woke up, which is another.
I think one thing for sure is, like, so if you look at the history throughout the 80s for a Priest and the music that they made, each sort of album they came up with was a Judas Priest album that had something new about it. And that newness sometimes came from what was trendy, what was innovative in the world of, you know, of heavy metal, of rock. And when they got to, by the time they got to Painkiller, it was really playing songs, playing music that was technically challenging. And that was, you know, Glenn's ability to play some of that technically challenging material. He's an innovator of some of the types of styles that he's played. You know, he took the lead at that point, really. He took the reins because the ability to play some of that incredibly technical lead stuff was his wheelhouse, and it stood out on those albums. The later, the basically from Painkiller through, I guess you might say, Redeemer of Souls, when Glenn was incredibly pronounced as the number one guitarist in Priest. That's not to say that KK wasn't a technically gifted guitar player. He was. He just had a style that I think took a little bit of a back seat through some of their evolutions, and not during some of the others.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, I think that was part of the reason why KK left. I think he felt that Glenn was getting a little too powerful. Kind of a mini dictator. But I don't know. I haven't read KK's book yet, to be honest with you. But from what I've heard and the little parts that I have read, I think that the main problem was between Glenn and him, and how Glenn kind of had an iron fist, hard as iron fist on the band. But that's just speculation on my part. Who knows what really happened? So the four singles kind of are the four singles that were released, Panic Attack, Crown of Horns, Serpent and the King, and Trial by Fire. They all seem to be different, I think, which really bodes well for the album. I think Panic Attack and Serpent and the King are kind of the most similar as far as the four singles. But, of course, by the time everyone's listening right now, the record will have been out, so I could be full of crap. But I think that the difference is, I think they picked four great singles to kind of show the variety of the album.
Yeah. So, absolutely.
But, you know, I'm not smart enough to schedule things in the right time, because I'm clearly an amateur. So again, people that are listening are like saying, what the hell are you talking about? The record's right here and it jams. But so we're looking forward to that. And we'll have a full review on the Priestcast with someone real exciting that we're real excited to have on. But anyway, since this is the baseball edition of the Priestcast, we thought we'd play a little game. What we did, and this was Sam's idea, I believe, which was an excellent idea, and Jeff's idea as well. I just kind of took a back seat, but it came together really well. What we did was we have five different categories that pertain to baseball. And we're going to pick songs from the Mighty Priest that kind of denote what we're talking about as far as the category. Whoa, I have no idea what I'm saying right now.
Well, you pretty well covered it. five baseball-related terms and themes, and a song that matches each one of those terms or themes in our eyes, however we view those meanings.
That's perfect, Sam. Behind the scenes, I got my times all mixed up from East Coast to West Coast, because you guys are on the East Coast and I'm on the West Coast, and I thought we were doing this on East Coast time. So actually, I just got out of bed. Jeff called me, said, "Hey, where are you, man? What are you doing?" And I'm sitting there laying in bed thinking, uh-oh. So that's why I can't really speak English today. But anyway, the categories are leadoff. So we're going to lead off with leadoff. Curveball, which is really interesting. Strikeout. And there are some definite strikeouts in the Priest catalog. Home run, which is self-explanatory, pretty easy. And we have closer, which is awesome. Closers are very important. So we're going to lead off with lead off, and I think we'll go snake again. So whoever goes third gets two picks in a row. I think we should let Sam get two picks in a row this time. So let's lead off with Jeff. Jeff, a leadoff song by the Mighty Priest.
So we mentioned Firepower earlier, and the title track, Firepower, is one of my favorite leadoff tracks on Priest albums. Firepower really sets the tone for the entire album. To me, it's important that the first track of an album encompasses all the different things that you were going to get on the rest of the album. If you throw out a track first that doesn't do anything that represents the rest of the album. It feels weird. I think Firepower comes out. It announces this album is kicking ass, so get ready. And Firepower is just a banger. It hits hard. Halford, almost a statement of intent by him where he is going to thrash through everything and leave bodies behind. Just an incredible fucking track.
Awesome. Firepower, the title track to Firepower, which is one of your favorite Priest records.
It is.
Nice. This set list just let off with a friggin' banger. So we've been doing this for a while. This is our sixth episode, I think. And I seem to always pick the same songs when we do these episodes, because there are certain songs that I love. But I want to change things up a little. Still an excellent song. But I'm going to lead off with Heading Out to the Highway from Point of Entry, 1981. Now, that was the third single released off of Point of Entry, actually, which is interesting, but I think it's the most popular song off of Point of Entry. It's a, you know, it's a Priest classic, and it still finds its way onto the set list at times. Great riff, real catchy chorus, almost kind of pop vibes, much like Point of Entry, the album, which is much more radio-friendly, commercial-type album. But kicks ass nonetheless. Everyone knows this song. It's a Priest staple. Great way to lead off a record. Catchy, high energy. Great driving groove. Like just heading out to the highway, sitting on a Harley or driving your pickup truck through the desert. Great driving song. They played it 459 times live. So it really finds a way on set list still. Actually, it was the first song to reach the U.S. charts, and it came in at number 10 back in 81. So it's a song about freedom and being in control, just heading on down that highway, feeling free, kicking some ass, taking some names. That is my leadoff from Point of Entry, Heading Out to the Highway.
All right, I mean, I'm up. Okay, so the one I chose is a little bit interesting, because not only is it not the first track on an album, it was probably not, wouldn't be considered a leadoff track until the 50th tour, when Priest led off with One Shot at Glory. From the album Painkiller. And I wouldn't be surprised if you had an honest poll of people who saw the 50th anniversary tour, if that was the first time that they had even heard that particular song. I bet there was a decent chunk of the audience that let it either had forgotten it or never even heard it to begin with, even people who are reasonably familiar with Priest. And I thought that was a really bold move to say, all right, we're going to take for our 50th tour, we're going to open up with a song that we haven't played live. We haven't played this live. It's from Painkiller. It's a later track on the album, but hey, it fits as an opener. And it really did. You know, it was a really great opener. I think it gave a shot of kind of adrenaline into that tour, and kind of helped us remember something that, you know, in the case of Painkiller, sort of a deeper track that's not really a deep track anymore, because most of the world that's seen Priests in the past, you know, basically anyone who's seen them on the 50th tour is going to have heard it now. So that's my pick.
Awesome pick. And like what we were talking about earlier, the dueling solos between Glenn and KK in that song are just mind-blowing. And yeah, that was out of the blue that they would pick that song, because like you're saying, you know, not everyone was familiar with that song, and it is a deep cut, so that is awesome. And that's a good way to approach that too, Sam, coming out of left field. We were all looking at album openers, But you came at it at tour opener. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Snake draft, you're up again. Curveball.
All right. So I'm up for curveball. So the curveball I'm going to put in here. And I guess so for the purposes of defining what I was looking at for curveball was something I guess would be a bit of a surprise, or maybe a bit of a break from the typical or the usual. And I think that's the case with this song, particularly if you reflect on Judas Priest's career as a whole, which is the song Epitaph from Sad Wings of Destiny. It's a different, at the time, it was something the Priest stylistically that fit. But I think the more time went on, the more that song felt like a curveball in comparison to the category. It's piano driven. It was featuring largely Rob's kind of natural baritone rather than what we're used to, which is his kind of baritenor, you know, accessing the high end, highest ends of his range, despite where his speaking voice and perhaps even natural vocal range might be a little lower. He sang right into to his baritone range in that song. It sounds like the kind of song that would have been more at home on maybe Queen or Led Zeppelin for an album in terms of stylistically, but it's really a great Priest song in and of itself. It's just a curveball in comparison to what reflectively we take from Priest. So that's my choice. It's one I love to listen to every so often, whether or not I'm listening to the whole album, Sad Wings. I like to fire up Epitaph.
You are killing me. That was my pick.
That was your curveball.
Yeah, that was my curveball. Everything you said, I totally agree with. It's definitely a nod to Queen. And boy, the piano on the early Priest records, I love, especially Sad Wings of Destiny. The piano's amazing on that album. And yeah, everything you said about Epitaph, Rob says, as there are no places for children in our modern cities, there's also no place for the old. And it's simply frustrating for me to see how these old human beings are forced to live their lives. That's what he says about the song Epitaph. But it's amazing. He wrote it in his early 20s, and it's so impactful, the lyrics. It's masterfully written for a young lad. But yeah, that's definitely a curveball. Excellent pick. That's awesome. You stole it from me, but I still like you. It's okay. We're still buds. All right. Curveball, Jeff.
I went with the longest song in Priest's catalog. And actually, if we're doing like curveball and closers coming up next, maybe not, whatever. So I had alternated my curveball and my closer kind of back and forth. So with curveball, I'm going to go with Loch Ness. It's a 14-minute song. It has like 3 minutes in the middle of it, from like 7 minutes to 10 minutes or something, where there's no vocals. It's just all lead work and solos. It's almost like a Megadeth trading off solos exercise. It's a very atmospheric and moody song. And it's got incredible lyrics with, and when listening to it, and you have the mood of the music and the lyrics just really bring me into this meditative state. It's just a really badass song.
Yeah, your love for Loch Ness baffles me, but here okay. It is again. Loch Ness for the doomy. Yeah, I'm not a fan. It's just too long and plodding for me. I'm into the quick hitters.
What you describe as plotting, I describe as perfect.
Yes, yes. The dichotomy of us. Curveball, since Sam stole Epitaph, which I thought was so smart and sneaky on my part, I almost didn't even have a backup because I figured there was no way anyone's going to pick Epitaph. But I'm going to go with Lone Wolf from Firepower 2018. I love the kind of jazzy intro. The song is a definite curveball from the rest of the record, from the rest of Firepower, I think. It's more kind of jazzy and swingy. Some parts are kind of reminiscent of Genocide, you know, that part of Genocide. It kind of reminds me of that in some places, which is really cool. Kind of reminds me in some parts of like Burning Up or Evil Fantasies as well. Kind of has that groove swing deal going. The riff is spectacular. But what really sets this song apart for me is really the bridge parts. The bridge into the intro, into the solo, but the bridge parts and the intro is what I'm trying to say. Kind of swingy. I think the song is about someone's alter ego and inner mental struggle. Kind of like Nostradamus. The theme of Nostradamus is kind of about an alter ego and kind of an internal mental struggle. But the song's riff is heavy. Sound is dynamic, but the other parts are a bit jazzy and swingy, which makes it quite unique, which makes it a curveball. Definitely a curveball in my book. And my favorite song off of Firepower, actually, Lone Wolf. Cool.
So do we want to, you might just delete this after, you want to take it back to Jeff to give, since we're doing Snake Draft, and that was your take for Curveball. I think Jeff should then have a second pick, and then it goes back to you and me, right?
Yeah, we fucked up the order.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Yeah. When you went to me, I thought you were just like giving up your choice on Epitaph.
Oh man, I'm totally. So what order? Where are
we? So technically, it would have been me. So it would have been me giving my lead off, and then my curveball, then you giving your curveball, which you didn't have one, Jay, but then you did. So we can just put the one that you just said in there for the curveball, and then Jeff would have picked his curveball, and then his strikeout would be next.
I got so me for a strikeout, then back to Jay, and then back to Sam.
Right.
This is going to be a killer in editing. I don't even know how I'm going to do it.
I don't think it'll be too bad.
We'll figure it out.
I think we'll just leave the whole motherfucker in. I fucked up. I just woke up. I just rolled out of bed and fucked up the whole thing. So, and I really suck at editing anyway, so I think we'll just go balls out and just leave it in here. So remind me of what we're doing now.
So we're gonna get a strikeout from Jeff, then a strikeout from Jay, and then a strikeout from me. Then I do the next category and go back to you, Jay.
Okay, so we're doing strikeout from Jeff.
Yep.
Sweet.
My strikeout is Cyberspace off of Demolition.
Wow.
Demolition is a so first off, I don't dislike the Ripper Owens. I'm not going to wipe him off immediately. I really, really, really like Jugulator. It's one of my favorite Priest albums. Demolition is a terrible follow-up. It's a horrific album. And Cyberface is probably the worst song on the worst album. It has terrible lyrics like "Don't access the site or beware his megabyte." English is crying right now over the torture. Drooling lips, his circuits lit, he crouches for attack. It's just I don't know what they were trying. Well, I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to be modern. But it is a terrible fucking song.
That's putting it bluntly. That's why we love you, Jeff. It's a terrible fucking song. All right, strikeout. Now that we're back in order, I guess. I'm going to go with Johnny B. Good from Ram It Down, 1988. This debacle. Is a Chuck Berry cover that was recorded for the soundtrack of a movie of the same name. The movie starred Anthony Michael Hall along with Robert Downey Jr. and Uma Thurman. The movie was a huge fucking flop, and this song is a huge fucking flop as well. Jesus. The dislike for this song in my book is way up there. Priest was asked by the producers of Top Gun 2 years prior to Johnny B. Good. They wanted Priest to do a song they wanted to use Reckless, actually, from Turbo, your favorite album, Jeff. Bad choice. They wanted to put Reckless in Top Gun, but the Priest and all their smarts there declined. Just think of, man, if Reckless was in Top Gun, a huge movie, I mean, that all the glory would have been brought to Priest, a lot more fans probably. They realized it was a huge mistake. So when that stupid movie Johnny B. Good approached them to make a song, they jumped right on it. And, you know, unfortunately, that debacle is what happened. They took a beautiful Chuck Berry song and made Johnny B. Good, and it's horrible, and I hate it. And that is my strikeout, and always will be. Excuse me. All right, so we're going to Sam.
Yeah, all right. So this one I picked out, it was a pretty easy choice for me. It's a track from Turbo. The track is Parental Guidance.
No disagreement here. That's a terrible song.
Yep.
So not only is it bad, but it is very clearly attempting to be something very specific and failing. And the best way I can think to put that, you know, it's almost like it was trying to be a Twisted Sister song, right? You know, kind of thinking about We're Not Going to Take It, right? Like, Parental Guidance has those same vibes. It just doesn't do it right. So it feels like an impostery kind of track. Like, Priest, let's make a teen rebellion song, okay? Don't need no parental guidance here, right? It's so literal. It's just sort of cheesy. And I do really like a lot of that album, but that one just doesn't do anything for me. And it's just so obviously calculated, designed to be something that's just not what Priest is about or ever was about. So yeah, that one is a pretty strong strikeout for me.
Yeah, good call. It's a horrible song. It was originally aimed at the PMRC for putting those stickers on albums, the parental stickers. I don't even remember what they said, but yeah. I mean, the song fits on Turbo, but it's just a horrible song. So I totally agree. Ouch. Yeah.
It's hard to take a song about parental guidance being sung by a 37-year-old millionaire seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. No, 100%. It just doesn't. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a little cringy. So I guess that brings me to, we're doing Home Run next, right?
Yes, sir. Home Run.
So, I picked a track from Firepower for Home Run, and I picked No Surrender. It was a short and pretty much perfect song. Very effective. It's had staying power on their set list, especially as it's taken on a new meaning during Glenn's battle of Parkinson's disease. But No Surrender is just sort of, for me, it's kind of a perfect home run heavy metal song. It's the right length. It is got all the ingredients of really the things that made Firepower a great album. It's heavy, catchy, and so that's my home run.
Awesome, good choice, and kind of out of the blue. I'm always expecting people to pick, you know, their favorite Priest song, you know.
Well, you know what?
What's Beyond the Realms of Death or something.
What spurred it on for me was somebody had asked, and I was having a conversation with someone, like, what's your favorite Priest song since the reunion? And I said, I don't know. That's a really hard one to answer. And I said, but something tell like I for I don't know that No Surrender is for sure my bear, but it's not, the answer is not no for No Surrender. It could be my favorite in the reunion era. And it's, like I said, it's short, sweet, and pretty much perfect.
Awesome. Excellent choice. So since I'm all out of order, I don't know who's next.
I believe you are with a home run for us.
Okay. My home run is Here Come the Tears, Sin After Sin, 1977. Now, this song touches all the bases. Rob's beautiful crooning voice, full of emotion. The emotion in this song is amazing. Then you get Rob's regular chess voice and all of a sudden the patented Rob scream. And you get the beautiful acoustic guitar, a little piano, which I love. Piano in the early Priest, you get a little piano in Here Come the Tears. I love the use of the piano and the emotions. The emotion Rob puts in his performance really match the deep meaning of the lyrics. Likewise, Glenn's solo has so much emotion. It sounds like Glenn's crying through his guitar, for kind of crying for Rob. It's amazing, the emotion in this song. Rob said of Here Come the Tears, Here Come the Tears was a cry for help. Glenn and I wrote this gentle, bruising song, and it was cathartic for me as I poured out my lonely heart about my compromised life. Here Come the Tears was very maudlin and a definite wallowing in self-pity. It was me at 26, singing that I was all alone and probably always would be, seeing that homosexuality in those days was still the love that dare not speak its name. So that's what that song's about. It's a brilliant song, brilliantly written, brilliantly performed. It really transforms you into the emotion of the song. You feel for Rob being a closeted gay man, the desperation and the longing for true love, and the understanding, the isolation he feels, that he has no one to talk to, no one to be with, no one to share his life with. He's really lonely, and he's sexually frustrated at the time too, and really depressed about the whole thing. And you hear all those emotions come through in the song, and even musically you can hear the emotion, especially with Glenn's kind of weeping solo. Oh, it's just, I love Here Come the Tears, one of my favorite Priest songs ever. It's just great. I love it. A home run for me, Here Come the Tears.
All right,
so who's next?
It'll be Jeff.
Oh, you're, we can't hear you, man. You're on mute.
There we go.
All right. Here we go.
I chose a deep cut off of Stained Glass. I've chosen Saints in Hell. It's one of my favorite Priest songs. It is, the lyrics to me are the key. The lyrics and the vocal delivery are the things that carry this song. It's a song about personal struggle as told through an allegory of religiosity. It has a deep emotional well to it. And at the same time, Glenn and KK come roaring in with providing some excellent riffs backing up Rob just shining on the song. I always thought that this was a wildly popular Priest song. Turns out they've only performed it like 55 times live, in 2018. So, Saints in Hell, that's my home run.
Awesome. Yeah, excellent song. Excellent deep cut. Love it. All right, so I guess we are going to closer.
So right, I chose.
Am I on it?
No, it's me again.
Cool.
So I chose Cathedral Spire. So I was mean to Ripper earlier. I'm going to support him now with the best of his songs. Cathedral Spire closes out. I just realized I made this playlist like a half hour longer than it needs to be. So Cathedral Spires closes out Jugulator. It is the best song that he did with them. It's a progressive epic. And the Ripper really carries this song with a very, this is one of the few songs on Jugulator that he's not trying to imitate Halford at all. This is a Ripper song. He goes into a lower register. And there's even like gang vocals towards the end. So Cathedral Spires, that is my choice for closer.
Excellent, excellent, just excellent. All right, I'm still fucked up on the order, so.
It's you.
It's me. All right. To close things out, a closer, one of my favorite albums I always get shit on for is Nostradamus. But Future of Mankind closes out Nostradamus. Future of Mankind is my closer. Of course, Don Airey on keyboards, which is awesome throughout this record. And this song sums up Nostradamus nicely. Lyrically, it puts a seal on the whole album, but leaves kind of a vague opening for a little more, actually. It starts with a huge Scott Travis drum sound, then a little Don Airey in there, and a simple but effective riff. It's a simple song, mid-tempo, but really effective. Still a banger. Great guitar work on this whole album. Some guitar-many in the bridge, then a mellow but smoking solo by Glenn. The solo in this song really fits the mood and fits the album perfectly. And then the end mirrors the opening of the track, or it mirrors the opening of the album, I should say. So it all goes back, kind of like on Mindcrime, how it all goes back to the front. I love Nostradamus. It's a top 10 Priest record for me, and I actually reach for it often. So perfect closer, Future of Mankind, my closer.
Nice.
That's a good choice. So you mentioned Mindcrime. What year did Mindcrime come out?
1988.
What year is our spinner?
1988.
Okay. Well, I think we do.
I still got to give you a closer, Sam's, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tried a good segue and it didn't fucking work.
That's okay. We could plug it in.
Yeah. If I knew how to edit, it would have fit perfectly, but we're just going to leave the whole motherfucker in. My balls are already hanging out.
just cut right to Jay's pick after I get mine. Just mention it. I will underhand toss to the segue if I can.
We're just hanging balls out, man. I'm not editing anything.
All right, sounds good.
People know we're stupid, so.
It's interesting. So our closer, in baseball is of course, the pitcher who comes in for one or a couple innings in a close situation to get the win, right? And a closer does their job. They get the save, right? They save the game.
Yep.
And so I actually went with that definition when I picked my closer, because I took a song from an album that I think actually needed a strong performance to come in and, for lack of a better word, get the save, because it was close. And I think it was a win as an album, but it was close. And that is the aforementioned album, Point of Entry, and the song that I think saved Point of Entry is Desert Plains.
Beautiful.
I think that's it's such a song, and even within the song, it's similarly to Heading Out to the Highway. It has a narrative with visual being told through the lyrics, but also has a really interesting and unique syncopation of the bass line that goes kind of counter the guitar and drums, and in a way that makes it just really kind of musically interesting. And it grooves. I do think it is gets the save for Point of Entry if it was sort of on middle ground in terms of, is this a good album or not? I think that Desert Plains is the one that says, yeah, this is a good album. This is a good album. It's possibly a little underrated.
That awesome. Is, per your definition of save, that is a perfect choice. That was a good call.
Thank you.
Excellent way of thinking outside the box, which you've done this whole time. Your brilliant mind is smoking, man. That's awesome. All right. So that was our baseball edition, and our set list came out Firepower, Heading Out to the Highway, One Shot at Glory, Epitaph, Loch Ness, Lone Wolf, Cyberface, Johnny Be Good, Parental Guidance, No Surrender, Here Come the Tears, Saints in Hell, Cathedral Spires, Future of Mankind, and it closes out with Desert Plains. I think that's an awesome set list.
Well, the middle three are going to be skips for a lot of people.
Yeah, maybe we won't put this one out, but there are some duds since we had the strikeout category, but well, it is what it is. It's Priest. You can't go wrong about. With some Priest. Yes, exactly right. So since we screwed up the segue into the spinner, let's just head right on into the spinner. The spinner spit out the year 1988 last time, which is just a historic year in music. I mean, I was looking at the albums released in 1988, just starting with some of the A's and B's and C's. I mean, AC/DC, Anthrax, Anvil, Armored Saint, Blind Guardian, Bolt Thrower, Carcass, Candlemass, Crimson Glory. That's just a small portion of the ABCs of the year 1988. It's just an amazing year. So I'm looking forward to this one. You want to go first, Jeff?
Sure. I chose Ozzy Osbourne's No Rest for the Wicked. I'm probably on mute, aren't I?
Nope.
Okay, good. We can hear you.
Good. So I chose No Rest for the Wicked, which I feel is a very underrated Ozzy album. It's, I don't know, it might be my second or third favorite of the Ozzy's discography. It has Breaking All the Rules, Bloodbath in Paradise, which might be my favorite Ozzy song, Fire in the Sky, Miracle Man. It's the return, or no, it's the debut of Zakk Wylde.
It is Zakk's debut, yeah.
Yeah, and it has Bob Daisley returning on bass and probably lyrics, because it's No Rest for the Wicked is a step up over, why can't I think of the previous, Ultimate Sin, lyric-wise.
Yes.
And production. And Ozzy's at the top of his game.
Oh, totally. I totally agree. No Rest for the Wicked is probably after the first two records is my favorite by far. Love that record. Excellent choice, man. Love that record. Old school metal. I mean, old school metal. You can't go wrong. So I think we're going to let Sam close it out. So I'll go next. And mine is actually a live album. I picked Nobody's Perfect from Deep Purple. It's a live double album that features the Deep Purple Mark II lineup, which is my favorite Purple lineup. Ian Gillan, Richie Blackmore, Roger Glover, Ian Paice, and of course, John Lord. Now, they reunited for 1984's Perfect Strangers, but this album was in support of the House of Blue Light. And the track listing is awesome. Highway Star, Child in Time, Lazy, Space Truckin', Knocking at Your Back Door, etc. I mean, excuse me. It's a four record or double CD. So it has, man, it has all the hits, mostly from the Mark II, which is, that, like I said, my favorite Deep Purple, one of my favorite bands. A lot of cool little jams within the songs. The music's really tight and spectacular, but of course, you know, Deep Purple's kind of like a jam band. When you see them live, they go into all these different parts of different songs and incorporate, you know, songs from other people and just kind of jazz and groove on the spot. And that's part of what makes Deep Purple Deep Purple, especially live. One of my favorite bands, Perfect Strangers, is one of my favorite Deep Purple records, actually. So Nobody's Perfect, Deep Purple, 1988. And Jeff, by the way, we forgot to do your connections to Priest.
Oh, I think that one's obvious. It's Ozzy.
Yeah.
There's no connection that needed.
Yeah. Okay. I totally agree. Deep Purple, I mean, there are, like with Ozzy, there's too many connections between Priest and Deep Purple. But some of them are Roger Glover produced Sin After Sin. Before Glenn Tipton joined Priest, his band, The Flying Hat Band, opened for Deep Purple. Sin After Sin drummer Simon Phillips played on Roger Glover's solo record. Let's see, drummer Les Binks played with Ian Gillan. In Rock is one of KK's favorite records and a real influential metal record for about everybody. Of course, Don Airey of Deep Purple played keyboards and double-tracked the bass on Painkiller and Touch of Evil. Also played keys on Nostradamus. And, you know, they've been on the same bill several times, saw each other growing up, everything else. Good mates. So that is my connection with Deep Purple and Judas Priest. There are too many to name, but that's just some of them. All right, 1988, Sam.
Yeah, so mine is all the way at the other end of the alphabet. And it's an album that, well, first of all, make the connection to Priest after I drop the album. But this is an album that's one of my favorite guitar playing albums of all time. I think the artist in question, it's probably their best album. And it was like the beginning of a very big, fast, and shortly after kind of fizzling away peak for the artist in question. The band or artist, Yngwie Malmsteen's Rising Force, and the album is Odyssey, 1988. So, you know, you got a really, you know, up until that point, you know, Yngwie's first handful of albums were, you know, he did Alcatraz with Grant Bonnet, and then his first handful of solo, if you want to call them that, albums were heavily neoclassical, heavily guitar oriented. This was the most, I would say, commercial of Yngwie's albums. It has a handful of really kind of great radio singles, and it's also a great guitar album. You know, on vocals, you have Jolene Turner. Which is has ties to some of the aforementioned bands that we talked about in terms of he sang for. So remind me, he sang for Rainbow, which has a connection to Deep Purple. So that's obviously one. This the album Odyssey had. So personnel wise, there's ties to Ozzy there. We have Bob Daisley playing bass on the Odyssey album. Johansson Brothers played keys and drums on that album as well. So, you know, the tracks on that album, Rising Force is probably the one that's most known to people. It is the sort of a track named after the band. And then there's a handful of just really good, kind of top 40, sort of tracks. In fact, it was in the Billboard 200s. It peaked at number 40 in 1988 and remains Yngwie Malmsteen's highest charting release. Now, where is the connection between Yngwie Malmsteen's Odyssey or Yngwie Malmsteen in general and Priest? Well, lies in an individual we mentioned earlier, Ricker Owens, who would sing lead vocals for Yngwie Malmsteen in his both in studio and live in the 1990s. So that is the connection. It's a little bit of a tenuous one because he did not sing on that album in particular, but he did sing with Yngwie. And I'm trying to find the first album that Ricker did with Yngwie so I can tell you the name of it. It was was it 90s? It might have been 2000s.
I don't know, man. It's all you.
It was the album Inspiration 19. Nope, I'm sorry. That was the Jeff Scott Soto and Jolene Turner album of his. Bear with me.
You're as good on a computer as I am, it looks like.
It's Perpetual Flame.
What's Perpetual Flame? So Perpetual Flame would have been after G3.
Right. I know.
So 2008. Okay, so I lied. It was the 2000s, not the 90s. Or the 2000s, not the 90s. So Perpetual Flame had Ripper on lead vocals, and mixed by Roy Z.
Nice.
And I believe they toured on that, and that was probably it, because knowing how Yngwie and lead singers work, it didn't go too terribly long.
I think he was on he was on the next one too.
Yeah, like High Impact. Was he on High Impact? Yeah.
No, Relentless.
Oh, he was on Relentless as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so we did land a little bit of a. So then Spellbound would have been the first one that that was Yngwie literally playing everything, which was 2012. So three albums with Ripper. But yeah, that's my 88 to Priest connection.
Awesome. 88 was a huge year. So we have Ozzy, No Rest for the Wicked, Deep Purple, Nobody's Perfect, and Yngwie, Odyssey. But the elephant in the room, speaking of 1988, is, of course, one of the best records ever made in the history of mankind, Operation Mindcrime, which none of us picked, but I think needs a mention. Love that album.
It's the best concept album that I've ever heard. It has its little parts where the concept is a little tenuous, but I overlook it. The musicianship on that album is incredible. Scott Rockenfeld is an underrated drummer. The two guitarists are really just killing it. I prefer Operation Live Crime to the studio album because Jeff Tate is a little less screechy on the live album.
Yep.
A little more into his into a normal register, not as high pitched, dog whistly type stuff.
Right.
I absolutely adore Mindcrime. Needle Eyes is a fantastic track with it's super fast, which is unusual for me. It is just incredible. And Sweet Sister Mary is an epic song. I love there's no bad songs on Mindcrime.
No, Sweet Sister Mary is not only my favorite song on that album, but is one of my favorite songs of all time. I mean, Sweet Sister Mary, I could just listen to it over and over and over. The back and forth between Mary and Nikki, who's the character, the back and forth vocals is just friggin' beautiful. God, what a great album. I mean, everybody's heard it, so there's not much more any one of us can say, but we definitely had to give it a shout out. One of the best albums ever made. Just what more can you say about it? Just an awesome fucking album.
Indeed.
My favorite Queensryche album by far. Yeah, beautiful. All right. So we all got shit to do, and I'm still laying in bed. So let's spin the spinner, get out of here. This year, this episode, we had 1988, as you all know, and I'm kind of just talking shit because I don't know how to work my phone, apparently. So, all right, here we are. We're going to spin the spinner for our next episode. Here we go. Can you hear it?
Drum roll.
Sacrifice to vice. What year will suffice for the spinner? Oh. Looking in the 2000s here. 2007.
Ooh.
2007 is the year of the spinner. So that's one of the more modern years that the spinner has come up with. So that's cool. That's exciting. But Jeff, so who are you seeing that you have to
I'm on my way to see run? Vader into Inhuman Condition and Origin.
Awesome. So since I had my times fucked up, you're probably running late. So we'll get out of here. Sam, always a pleasure, man.
Thanks for having me again, guys.
Man, your knowledge and your thinking outside the box and your knowledge of music and the instrumentation therein is just awesome. We love having you. Always fun.
Love being on. It's fun to talk priest and music. Happy to join. Happy to be back.
Awesome. You're always welcome here, man. It was a pleasure talking to you.
So you're on X on.
I am Kicky Sam 49.
Kicky Sam 49. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I can be found talking baseball a lot. You can find me there.
Awesome.
This is the time of year where I talk a lot about baseball for sure.
Yeah. Sam's always got some excellent baseball takes. It's always fun seeing what he's got and the card collection and all that. And I would like to encourage everyone to join the Metal Gods Fantasy Baseball League.
Oh, right.
Just go to ESPN. It's all set up. So just go to ESPN, find Metal Gods, and join our Metal Gods Fantasy Baseball League. So thanks, guys. We're out of here. I'd like to thank the Deep Dive Podcast Network, Martin Popoff, and Rob Halford. And always keep defending the faith.